This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to the final best of the festivals for this Radio National Summer. I'm Cassie McCullough and today we'll hear from the best-selling writer Dervla McTiernan. In conversation with RN's Claire Nichols, McTiernan speaks about her new standalone thriller, The Murder Rule, inspired by the true story of a young law student who worked at the Innocence Project in the US and who uncovered evidence which exonerated a man who'd been in prison for 26 years.
So this one is set in Maine, in America. How does it feel to leave Ireland behind?
Oh, gosh, it's nice to take a break, to be honest. I don't know. I think this was a story that just had to be told in America because of the nature of it, because it relates to the Innocence Project, which is a very American thing, largely. And so it had to go there. But it was like going on holidays somewhere, you know. And I have a friend who is a writer, and I am convinced that she only sets her books in cities that she wants to visit because it's always Paris and New York. And then she can go on research trips. Natasha Lester's books are always in New York and Paris, and she always goes on these amazing research trips, and every time I see her Instagram photographs I think, why didn't I think of this? Why are all my books set in Galway? I'm going to Galway anyway. So I spent a summer in Maine years ago working, and it's partially set in Maine and partially in Virginia. I needed another state that would support the law that I was going to be working with, and so Virginia was a good fit. Plus, it looked really beautiful and leafy and green, and I thought, that sounds great to me.
So tell me about your time in America. When did you go and what were you doing there?
I was trying to work out how many years ago. I mean, it's 23 years ago. I am so old. I was a student, so it's a long tradition in Ireland. You can get what's called a J1 visa, which allows you to go for a summer if you're a university student and work there. And we all convince our parents that we're going to go and earn our college fees, and it doesn't always quite work out that way. But we do work hard. Everybody goes and gets at least two jobs. You work all hours and sleep all hours and sleep about 45 people to a room, and it's just really good fun. So I worked in Maine as a chambermaid and a waitress, and I lived with my best mate. And I had a lot of memories from those days. So there are parts in the book that sort of reflect that time for me.
What was the food like? Because, and this sounds silly, but in your book, people eat so many burgers.
A lot of burgers. I remember, it's so long ago now, and I know everything has changed, but I remember the contrast for me culturally coming from Ireland and going to the States, because just the portion sizes were like huge. I mean, it would feed three people, and you're like, what am I supposed to do with this? Now, I think that's changed. Ireland now, the portion sizes are pretty much the same, but in those days they weren't. So yeah, a lot of burgers. It depends how much you've traveled in the States. I haven't traveled as widely as I should have, but depending on where you are, there's such a contrast in terms of food availability, getting fresh food and stuff. It's not as available as it would be in Australia or Ireland. So burgers are prevalent.
Yeah, well, they taste
also
good
I
too.
Like a good burger.
Me too. But what about, what else struck you? I mean, being this Irish girl in America, what else struck you about the place or stood out for you?
I think it was just such a culture shock getting off the plane the first time, because we absorb a lot of American television in Ireland, you know, the same way we would here, and books and everything. And you think you know it as a country. You haven't got a clue. Because, first of all, it seemed very integrated to me coming from Ireland. And then I got off the plane and we got the yellow cab and from JFK and New York City, and you're so excited. And then you realize, hang on, we're driving through a neighborhood and I'm only seeing black people. So where are all the white people? And then you're in a neighborhood and it's only white people. And that was really quite shocking. And we worked every kind of job. You know, we worked as chambermaids and in delis and everything else. And you realize you're mostly working with Hispanic people. And you begin to realize it's actually not a very well integrated society at all. Now, this is a long time ago and probably things are different, but that's how it felt at the time. And then just culturally, things were different. We found, you know, dating was weird. That was a really weird one, because people just asked you out on dates. And this was very unusual, because in Ireland you have to get drunk first. It's just weird, daytime dates. So that was odd. And then the misconceptions people had about Ireland, you know, because we were, you know, quite a sophisticated economy at that stage. We were the biggest exporter of software in the world when I was in the States. And I remember being trained at the deli I worked in. And there was a young American guy teaching me how to use the till. He was like, this is a till. It's kind of like a computer. Do you guys got computers in Ireland? And I said, well, there's one in Kilkenny, but the queue is really long and I haven't seen it yet. And he went, right, right. Came from.
So. Anita Heiss told me the same thing about dating in New York. No, she got really freaked out because people just come up and ask her out, and it was apparently overwhelming for Australians too. I'm going to ask one slightly cynical question before we move on. In that book set in America, sell well to American audiences. Yes. Is that part of the appeal here?
I think so. I mean, it is part of the appeal. My publishing deal is with HarperCollins globally, and so writing books set in America is kind of part of that. But this story came along at the right time anyway, because I really want, as soon as I had been carrying it around for a long time, but it always felt really linear. I couldn't find a way in and I didn't know what to do with it. And then I had the idea of what I could do with it, and it was at the right time. So it was serendipitous.
Bit of both. Okay, well, let's go back to the starting point for this novel. Tell me about Niamh Gunn.
Yes, Niamh Gunn is a young, well, she was a young Irish student who used her time in America much more productively than I did. She went and volunteered for the Innocence Project while she was there. And when she came back to Ireland after her summer was over, she couldn't let go of a case she had been working, which was a case of a man called Walter Swift. So when she came back to Ireland, she kept making phone calls, kept trying to track people down. Ultimately, she found a retired police officer who pointed her to some evidence that had been hidden from the defence in the original case. And so, according to these newspaper articles I read, as a result of Niamh's hard work, this man, Walter Swift, was freed from prison. He was entirely innocent, which was amazing and incredibly inspirational, because obviously, you know, she did a hell of a lot more with her time than I had with mine. But I didn't feel like there was a story there for me to write, because it was, I felt like the story had been told, you know, it was done. And then I came back to it. I don't know if I came across the article or if it just kept nagging at me and I ended up looking it up. But then I read a bit more into it. And it turned out that after Niamh found the evidence that proved his innocence, it took another 5 years for the case to be heard, by which point he'd been in prison for 26 years and he only had 3 years left to run his original sentence, which was just tragic and awful and so much more complicated than the original story I had read. And I kept thinking, well, why was all this detail left out of all of these original articles that I read? You know, because this is surely key to the story. And I thought, well, maybe the editors of the newspapers felt like this was a more inspirational take, or maybe the Innocence Project had this sophisticated PR team and they're putting this story out into the world, which was very unfair because I had no reason to think that. But it made me think, okay, well, what if you are a good person in the world, as you would be working for the Innocence Project, really trying to make a difference, but you're working in the world we live in now, which is this post-truth world where basically you can say what you like, it seems like, and there are no consequences and nobody's listening. How far would you go to be effective? And would you take a step off the black and white path and step into somewhere slightly morally compromised? And once you do that, then would you take the next step? And would you take the next step? And where is that line for us now? You know, because I think that line is shifting. And so that was where I thought there could be a story to write.
Let's talk a little bit about the Innocence Project. I don't know about the rest of you, but I know about it from the Serial podcast and Adnan Syed. I mean, what can you tell us about this organisation?
Yeah, I came across them first years ago. I mean, they first rose to prominence, really, or got a lot of publicity in the States when DNA testing became a thing, because they were able to use DNA testing to absolutely prove beyond doubt that many of the people on death row and some people who'd already been executed were innocent. And obviously that was a bit of a kind of a blow to everybody, and they grew from there. There's some very high profile lawyers involved. You would probably have heard the name Barry Sheck. And I think there's sometimes a kind of a perception that they're a very highly funded, well organized, tightly knit single group, which is what my perception was as well. But actually, they're made up of lots of little volunteer groups spread across the country, very often attached to a university. And you often have young students volunteering. I mean, that's where they usually have staff lawyers who are paid, or professors who give some of their time. But a lot of the time it's young students.
I found that amazing. Like in the book, the students are so involved, and really these prisoners' futures really rest in the hands of these students, I remember, I'm sorry, I'm really lowering the tone today, but I remember Legally Blonde, you know, when they get like the kids onto the case and then representing in the courtroom. And I'm thinking this is completely unrealistic. Yeah. But in this case with the Innocence Project, it's actually not. It
does happen. I mean, I got a chance to talk to a couple of young guys who had volunteered for the Innocence Project the year before. And so we had a chance to talk about the work they had done, and here I heard from them firsthand. But also, it really brought back memories when I was a very young lawyer in my early 20s, and the first time you're asked to do anything that is actually real. And it's a bizarre kind of way to work, because in the early days, I was working for a law firm in Dublin, and when the firm was quiet and there wasn't a lot for me to do, I was photocopying or I was delivering things around Dublin. And sometimes I would pretend, because I was so bored, I'd put something in an envelope and I'd pretend I was delivering it, and I'd just walk around Dublin for an hour to get out of the office. But then equally, when things were busy, suddenly you'd get lumped with this thing that you really weren't qualified to deal with. And I mean, there was a year where I think we were... the euro was coming in and we were changing the year end of the financial year end in Ireland to match with European norms, and everybody was insanely busy, and there was this massive multinational and its company structure was going to fall apart because one company that was unlimited hadn't been registered. This is all terribly boring, I'm sorry. But it landed in my desk and I had to deal with this thing that was suddenly worth tens of millions of dollars with virtually no support from my training sister because he was dealing with something even bigger. And then the next day I was delivering papers again. Wow. And that's just the nature of it. You know, you have to start somewhere, and often it's somewhere you really shouldn't be starting.
Yeah, and if you're dealing with people on death row, etc. I mean, that's huge. I do wonder, though, with an organisation like the Innocence Project, you know, their drive is to prove someone's innocence, right? Mm. Like, that's kind of what they're set up to do. Their goal is in the title. Does that mean if they're already focused on that end goal of innocence, can they miss things along the way that could point in another direction? They've kind of got a motive, right?
Yes. Yeah, I thought that was something that was interesting to sort of think about, because you have to be single-minded, you know, and a lot of the people that you might be defending, it's not necessarily black and white. Well, maybe they're completely innocent of the crime for which they were convicted, but are they innocent of everything? And is it possible to be as blinkered on that side of the fence as you can be on the other side of the fence? I think one of the things that I keep coming back to is this idea of sort of self-righteousness, or being so utterly convinced of your side of the argument that you hear nothing else, and therefore you will do anything to advance your cause. And I think we're seeing that a lot with American politics, where people are being really pushed into ideological camps. And because you're pushed into ideological camps, and then with the rise of social media kind of refeeding that same story to you again and again, you become so completely convinced that your side is right and the other side is wrong that you stop paying attention to any conflicting evidence. And I think the science is showing that. Social psychologists who've looked at this are saying that's actually what we do. We don't go out there and make logical decisions informed by information. We actually seek out information that, you know, confirms our existing biases. That's just how our brains work as humans. So I think that that can affect people on the right side as much as it can affect people on the wrong side.
Yeah, so even in a very noble organisation like the Innocence Project, yes, it means things can go wrong.
Exactly, and you can miss things that you should be looking at a bit more clearly.
Was there any issue with using the name of the Innocence Project in this book? Like, you're not always glowing about the project. Do they know about it?
I don't know. I guess it remains to be seen. I was conscious of it because my Innocence Project is set in the University of Virginia, and there is a group of the Innocence Project in the University of Virginia, and it's headed up by these amazing women who have done really extraordinary work, and some of the cases they've won have just been, you know, so inspiring. My guys are completely different, and I was very careful to make sure that I didn't have any coincidental biographical overlap so that no one could misinterpret that I'm talking about someone from real life. No, I mean, look, I doubt they'd care, to be honest. I think that they're more focused on things that really matter in the world.
Good. Okay. So the book is called The Murder Rule. Our protagonist, I don't know if I should say heroine, but our protagonist is Hannah. Let's just run through to start, like, her basic stats. Who is she?
Okay.
What is she?
She is a very young law student. She has just transferred to the University of Virginia from Maine for reasons, and she sort of manages to get onto the Innocence Project team. And they're fighting to save a guy who is in prison. And Hannah appears to be exactly what you'd expect at first glance. You know, very, very clever, very dedicated, the kind of young person who wants to change the world and is also very, you know, eager to please and impress people. But that is not who she is at all.
This is Best of the Festivals on Radio National Summer, and we're listening to a conversation between writer Dervla McTiernan and RN's Claire Nichols about McTiernan's new thriller, The Murder Rule. The story is inspired by the true story of a young law student who worked at the Innocence Project in the US, and coming up, we hear readings from the book.
From Hannah Rokeby to Robert Parekh. Subject: Fall Semester 2019, Volunteer. Dear Professor Parekh, my name is Hannah Rokeby. I'm a third-year law student at the University of Maine, and I'm transferring to UVA Law this coming semester. I apologise for emailing you directly, but I understand that the official application period for the Innocence Project programme has closed. I am so eager to volunteer for the project that I thought perhaps I should write and appeal to you personally. I'm hoping you'll make an exception in my case. My mother has been ill with cancer for some time, and she's now enrolled in a medical trial at the University Hospital. I'll be attending UVA Law for the coming semester so that I can be close to my mother and reachable if she should need me. I have a 3.9 GPA, please see my attached transcript. I'm third in my class, and I've already completed 68 credits, so I'm well on track to graduate. I would therefore be able to dedicate more days and hours than most students to my work at the Innocence Project. I passionately believe in the work you do with death row prisoners and others who've been wrongfully convicted, and I would be so grateful to be given the opportunity to work for a cause that is so close to my heart. I can be contacted by email or by phone at any time. Sincerely, Hannah Rokeby.
And this is from Robert to Hannah. Dear Mrs. Rokeby, volunteer positions for the coming academic year have been allocated. The application process is highly competitive for the Innocence Project Clinic, and all positions are filled following rigorous interview in the final semester of the preceding academic year. For future reference, when assessing applications, I look for evidence of research dates and self-organisation, e.g. knowledge of application closing dates, as well as grades. Robert M. Parekh.
From Hannah to Robert. Dear Professor Parekh, thank you for your email. Perhaps I should have mentioned that I'm very good friends with a former student of yours, Annabel Bancroft. I expect that you remember Annabel, as I understand you worked very closely together. Annabel told me in detail about the personal mentoring you provided to her, which I found fascinating. I wonder if others would be as interested. I sincerely hope that you might reconsider my application, Hannah Rokeby.
From Robert to Hannah. Hannah, come and see me when you get here next week. We may be able to find a place for you, Robert M. Parekh. Okay, that was fun.
Cool.
So, why does she want to work at the Innocence Project?
Well, there's the official version and there's the not-so-official version. So the official version is in her email, obviously, and she wants to save the world. But the reality is that she wants to work on a particular case that is coming up, which is the case of Michael Dandridge, who has been in prison for a very long time. The Innocence Project believes he's wrongfully convicted. He's been convicted of rape and murder. The weird thing about his case is his conviction's actually already been overturned, but he's still in prison because the original DA wants to go again. And until such time as those charges have been heard, he has to stay in prison. So the Innocence Project believed that the DA was going to let this timeline just run out and that he would be freed, but that isn't what has happened. And so now they're scrambling. They've just got a couple of weeks to prepare for this hearing. And Hannah wants desperately to get on that case because she has reasons of her own to do so. I mean, she doesn't particularly want Michael to be freed from prison. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, she has suspicions of Michael relate to this case, but also something else that's happened in the past that he hasn't been convicted of. She's essentially a mole,
yeah.
Right?
She is, within
the Innocence Project.
Yeah. She's there to work against the team that she's supposed to be working with, and she has every intention of being effective at that. You know, that when I was mentioning earlier that she's so convinced she's right, that's her mindset going in. She utterly, utterly believes that she's on the right and that the guys in the Innocence Project are well-meaning but just a bit blinkered, you know?
Maybe blinkered, but maybe a bit more. Like, she says at one point, you know, the Innocence Project is guilty of romanticised bullshit, and she's very suspicious of this Parekh guy, yeah. You know, not just because of what she's outlined in the email, but, I mean, he
while being noble and having the right quest, he's also led by his own ego, right? Like he wants to be
well, she
the
sees
star.
Him that way. Yeah. You know, he's this really handsome guy. I mean, incredibly handsome and very charming and very conscious of his effect on people. He knows how people respond to him and he uses it. And he has a very, you know, high profile, personal profile. So he does newspaper interviews and there are photographs taken of him with his shirt slightly unbuttoned and all this stuff. And she sees this and she rolls her eyes and she thinks he doesn't care about the prisoners. He just does this so that he can be the savior, you know, the amazing guy who swoops in to save people. But I don't think she's, personally, I don't think she's right about that. You have to make up your own mind. I mean, for me, it's his view would be, I use this because I get the newspaper article and I get the interview because I'm willing to do these things. And as a result, my cause gets attention that it otherwise wouldn't get. And that matters. And for me, it's about, look, he's trying, his argument would be, I live in the world the way it is. I don't live in the world that I'd like to live in. I live in it as it is. And if I can sit at home and talk about this, or I can actually make a difference, and I'll do what I have to do to make a difference.
One thing I noticed about Hannah is she seems to need no sleep. she works all day and she works all night. Is this just part of the legal experience, Deborah?
Well, God, it was in the early days. I mean, I distinctly remember working till 3 a.m. on something when I was a young lawyer and, I was going to go home and my boss is like, I'll see you at 6. And I was like, Jesus Christ. There's no room for a shower in there, like let alone food, you know. And it's this macho thing where it's, you know, who can go the longest, who can do the most hours, and everybody's expected to do it. It's like medicine. Like, I did it, so you should have to do it, you know. I think it's stupid, but it is part of the culture.
I mentioned in the introduction that this book to me seems like less of a crime thriller, more of a legal thriller. Is that fair, first of all?
I think so. I never think like that when I'm setting out to write it, but I totally understand why people would see it that way. But I didn't think of the Cormac Riley books as police procedural books either, but they are, you know. So they fall into whatever category they fall into after you write them. And given the nature of it and given that there are courtroom scenes, I think that's fair.
I guess also it probably affects the way you plot and plan the book because, you know, in a police procedural, even if you're not looking at it that way, we've kind of got the central crime that kind of shapes the book and we're leading to the whodunit. You know, we might be flashing back to something from Cormac's past. You know, the structure is quite clear.
Well, the beauty of that, is that you can follow the investigation. So you always have something to move the plot forward with police procedural. So it's a nice one.
So how does that change when you kind of tweak what you're doing here and you're suddenly looking at the court system? Does that change the way you kind of plot and plan the pace of the book?
It does, because there's no basic infrastructure to build a book around in the same sense that there would be with a police procedural type book. You always have to have something of a linear investigation as at least one of the main plot lines with police procedural, because Cormac has to do one thing and then another thing and then another thing and then find this fact out and then find out that's not true and so on. Whereas this, there is sort of an investigation, but you're approaching it from a very different way. So it was more organic. It was just build the book as it came, and it was hard.
I don't know if this is A, because you're a lawyer, or B, because you're a writer, or probably a combination of both, that you're quite good at making us just skip over the kind of more dull stuff and get to the good stuff. I mean, but you've got to get it all right. Is that hard to tell us the information we need to know, but keep it pacey and exciting?
It is really hard in certain things, because some things are a bit obscure and you have to explain them for it to be interesting and for you to understand what comes next. But nobody wants to listen to chapter and verse on legislation. There's nothing worse. The research was hard because I hadn't studied American law directly. I mean, I had to a little bit for my work, but I wasn't an American law student. I was Irish. And so I had to come to the criminal law and figure out certain things. And it is really, I mean, I haven't read primary legislation like that in a very long time. And I realised why I'm no longer a lawyer.
What you do is a bit more fun.
Yeah, way more fun.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Hannah's mum, Laura. You heard in those emails at the start, she says, my mum's sick in hospital. That's not true.
No.
It becomes clear very early. So tell us about Laura and what Hannah and Laura's relationship is like.
Well, at the beginning of the book, in the very first chapter, you learn that Laura is an alcoholic. And I don't know if it's evident from the book, but what it was in my head is that, you know, well, it is probably evident from the book. Laura's alcoholism has affected their family life always. It's always been there. Her unhappiness and the trauma that she went through. She went through a very traumatic situation as a young woman, and she's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, really, and her alcoholism is part of that. So that's one of the reasons Hannah's so competent, because she had to be a carer quite early on. And so from the beginning, you see Hannah in a very protective role. You see that they love each other very much. And you see that Hannah seems to be taking pretty extreme action that she thinks is there to help and protect her mother. But that's, for me, that's kind of the first picture you get of them. And then what I was trying to do was sort of move the camera lens closer, bit by bit, or at a slightly different angle. So you look at them and you say, oh, does that match with my first impression? Hang on a second. Is that adding something here? Am I learning something new about them? And are they really who I thought they were? And then ultimately you do get an answer to that. But I would like you to have that experience of kind of questioning it as you go along.
What did you have to learn about alcoholism?
Well, I think I knew what I needed to know, really. I mean, look, I don't think it's peculiar to Ireland. I think everybody has family members who have had to deal with that. I mean, I was very conscious that alcoholism is a disease for most people, not for everybody though. I mean, if some people abuse alcohol but are not addicted to it, it's a different mechanism, if you like. I was very interested in different things about, I have been generally very interested in different things about treatment methods and the you know, the public perception versus the reality of what's out there. I read a fascinating article about, you know, the actual effectiveness of AA, for example, which is not very effective based on information that there's very little scientific information available about the effectiveness of AA programs because they're not reported. But based on the information that is available, they're generally not actually very effective. And there is also public perception that it has to be all or nothing, that people should absolutely give up alcohol completely if they want to move forward with their lives, and that's the only way. But in fact, not everybody can do that. And there are other treatment methods available through your GP and other things that can support you in living a functional and happy life, even if you're not able to let go of alcohol completely. So those sorts of things interest me always, you know, the kind of public perception versus reality.
How resentful is Hannah towards her mum and the upbringing that she's had?
I think in her conscious mind, she's not resentful at all. She genuinely doesn't see it like that to the degree that she's aware of it. But in my mind, at the beginning of the book, when Hannah's taking quite extreme action, she thinks she's doing it for her mum. But I think she's partly doing it for herself. I think maybe there's some part of her that just wants to tear it all down because maybe she recognises things aren't quite where they should be.
You know, Hannah, she's a great daughter, and she makes a lot of excuses for her mum and her behaviour. And fair enough, because as you say, Laura has been through some really traumatic things. But later in the book, Hannah meets another law student and his family, and she notices that they've been through some quite traumatic events in their life and some hardship, yet they seem to have been able to put that behind them and move on as a solid family base. What's the difference between those families, you know, that one was able to cope and one wasn't?
I think in the case of the book, it comes down to who the mothers are in that situation. They're both very different people. Sean's mum has been through really terrible times, but she's a different person to Laura. And I feel like if I really answer the question fully, it's going to give away the
big
twist. I can't do that to you guys. So I can't answer too directly, but I will say I think it comes down to who they are as people. And I have to stop there. Every sentence I can think of is going to just give
goodness.
It.
I guess what I'm getting at though is, like, do you think that, you know, people can go through great hardship and move on?
Yes, I do. I absolutely do. And look, I'm not trying to judge anybody because everybody's personal circumstances are different. And maybe you get a little stroke of luck at the right time, or just the right small little bit of support that sets you on a better path. But I absolutely believe you can go through hard times and come out the other side. Like, not endlessly. We all have a limit, you know, and sometimes things are just too hard. But I think in most cases, yes, you can come through. I mean, we've seen that. We see people who deal with terrible traumas all the time.
Okay. Now, I mentioned earlier that I've been to Devla's house, so I can vouch for how diligent she is. She had...
And how messy it is.
It was very clean when I came, but I think people often clean up before I come over.
Yeah.
She's got a calendar on the wall with everything that's coming up, and then I got to see your colour-coded spreadsheets of how you plot and plan your book. You are really writing to a schedule now. You're working on... It's a book a year, right?
Can you outline for everyone here just what your process is and how you actually get a book written in a year?
Yeah, it's going to sound horribly controlling, but it's the only way that works for me. I kind of have fallen into a method. So I usually start with the character. I have a pretty good idea who the character is going to be and the situation. So in this case, it would have been, I knew this young woman who was very bright and very capable, was going to come in and try to pull a case down from the inside out. And I knew she was going to be pretty ruthless and tough, but I also wanted her to have goodness at her heart. I wanted to like her. And so then I had to figure out who that person is. So I start with a sheet of paper and like literally a character prompt sheet that you can get on the internet. I will have lists of questions like age, you know, date of birth, where did she grow up? Does she have family, brothers and sisters, friends, first boyfriend, any injuries, you know, random things. But they just prompt your imagination and help you start thinking about it. And I'll write out character sheets for everybody that will grow new characters. And then when I've finished doing that, I will think of between 7 to 10 scenes that I'm really excited about writing. They don't have to be in order. They don't have to make sense together. It's just like, oh, that's going to be so fun to write that one. And once I've done that, I'll start writing. I write about 30,000 words usually. And then I kind of know I've found the voice, or I've found the bit that excites me, that I think there's going to be a through line. This is where the story lies with this story. Then I'll write a full outline, which would be pretty detailed. It'll usually run to 4 or 5 pages, just a little paragraph per chapter. And then I start writing. And I just write all the way through. But I will stop and abandon that outline at any point if it stops working for me. And I will then probably start again. Because usually it takes writing the book to go, oh, that's the good stuff, or that's not working. That just never, I thought it could be this, but it didn't happen, you know. And then I'll go back and go again. So then I usually have done at least 2 or 3 drafts, full drafts, before it goes to my agent.
We're listening to award-winning author Dervla McTiernan speaking with Claire Nichols about her latest book, The Murder Rule. This is Best of the Festivals on Radio National Summer, and coming up, we hear what challenges McTiernan faced in writing this book and what's ahead in her writing.
What were the hard bits or the stumbling blocks with this particular book?
Laura's diary entries were the hardest by far, because it's a it's sort of a dual timeline novel. That there are fewer diary entries than there are Hannah's entries, but in the beginning, Hannah's entries were kind of popping along very nicely, and I didn't feel Laura's were doing the same, and I was really worried because we've all read lots of books for their due timeline, and one of them you love and the other one you're just bored silly by, and you're just flipping through the pages quickly to get back to the one you actually want to read about. And I think it kills the book for me when that happens, so I was trying to avoid that. And I couldn't get the lower chapters where I wanted them to be. And I think the problem was I couldn't decide if I was going to make her good or bad. And I was trying to make her both. And I couldn't do that. I had to make a decision who she really was at her core. And then I could write it accordingly. Once I did that, I knew. But I have at least 3 versions of those that are finished, complete, and totally different from each other. Different scenes, different scenarios, different everything.
Different outcomes of whether she's good or bad.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
So could have been a completely different book.
It could have been not as good. I hope I heard the right choice.
I mean, you talk about those stumbling blocks and writing that diary and going, is this right, is this right, is this right?
Yeah.
How do you know when it's right? How do you know that this one is better than those other ones?
You just feel it physically. There's a book by a writer called Elizabeth George called Right Away, and she talks about her writing method, most of which I have stolen. So if you read it, you'll hear some familiar things. But she talks about knowing when you've got a story idea or not. And she says, look, you can think with your brain, yeah, this is clever and I can do this and it's topical and da-da-da. But she said, you know, it's going to take you a couple of years to write a book. And that's hard. Emotionally, you have to be committed to it the whole way through, and you have to care about it. And so if you don't feel something really strong in the beginning, it's not going to be there at month 8 or 18. So she said, you look for like a visceral, almost punch, like a physical reaction. And when you feel that, you know you've got something. And I completely agree with that. When you know it's working, when you can feel it, and when you're starting to just push it along with only your brain and no heart, you've lost it somewhere and it needs to go again. And then when you're rereading, once you get over that first few moments of awkwardness, are you feeling it or are you just like ticking boxes in your head?
Do you get stuck?
Rarely I do, but I kind of know now what that feels like and I know what to do. It usually means I haven't done enough work, that there's more work to be done in building the story up, and I'm going into a scene too light. So I work on pen and paper first before I start working on keyboard, and I have a lot of work done. I know who the characters are, I know what they're thinking, what they want going into the scene, I know the physical location, I know probably what's going to happen next. And then I try and take some time to say, well, what am I really trying to achieve as a writer in this scene? I try and work all that out before I start writing.
Wow.
If I haven't done enough of that beforehand, then yes, I'll get stuck. And sometimes it's tempting, if the words are coming really fast, to just run with it. And I've done that any number of times. And every time I do, I think, this is great. You know, I've learned how to write organically and it's all going to be beautiful. And then I hit a brick wall and I realize, no, I've just been lazy, actually. And it's not as good. And I need to go back and put in the work. And I know other writers write very differently, but I think we all have to find our own path.
Yeah, you are definitely a planner, not a pantser. I think, yeah, we can agree on that. I'm sure people hear that, you know, there were those sighs of horror, perhaps, when I said that this was not a Cormac Riley book. Are you going back there? Because I'm sure, knowing you, you've got the next project well underway.
The next one is not a Cormac Riley one. I'm not saying I will never write another one, but when I started writing The Ruin, it was never actually intended to be a series. It was going to be just one story, which was Maud's story, and then it became Cormac's story. And then, you know, it became a series. And I was really happy to write the series because I felt like there was more story that needed to be finished off. But even when I was writing The Scholar, I kind of knew it would finish in three, and that would be it. I think there are more stories in that world. Whether it would be a Carrie book or a Cormac book, I don't know. But I'm just not ready to go back there yet. I feel like Cormac went through a lot and he needs a break for a while.
You kind of giggling with glee last time when you told me about all the things you were putting him through.
Yeah.
He said it had all been Cormac. Too good for him and you had to make his life tough.
Well, I do feel that way about it. I know people really like him, but I feel like he had it easy in his life. You know, he was this good-looking guy who played sport in school and played it well. He's always been well-liked. He chose a profession that suited him, so he did well in it. He was part of this band of brothers. Like, his life was pretty charmed until I came along and messed it all up for him. But I think he's a good person, and I think he was still a good person at the end, and that's what I really liked about him, because when things did get tough, he didn't just abandon it and take the easy route. He was willing to sacrifice and try.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. The Murder Rule. TV deal?
Yeah, exciting. So FX is a TV channel in the US. I wasn't as familiar with them as I should be, but they're really big. They go into 90 million households and cable, and they've made some premium dramas like The Americans and Nip Tuck and Sons of Anarchy and that sort of thing. So they're known for making that sort of thing. So my agent sent it to them, and they were very excited, and they really like it, and it's apparently going into production. So
wow.
It's very, very exciting for a limited series.
Fantastic. I mean, and what do you know about
time to
hear
some questions
world
from the audience
of, you know, of TV deals?
Nothing. Only what I'm told, usually. I know very little. I mean, the interesting thing about this one is I've been able to get the notes from the writers were shared with me from the screenwriters, which was really cool. And I got to share my thoughts about what I felt was most important about the book. But it's really cool getting to see other writers' takes on your characters. Like, I don't think they knew that their notes were going to be shared with me, because they're not trying to be nice, you know. They're just going for it. And it was really cool because they saw things I didn't see, and then some places we completely matched up and other places we didn't so much, and it's been really interesting.
I always just think it would be so hard to let go of your baby and let other people take it on. Is there any of that there?
Not yet. I don't feel that way. I know a lot of writers do. I don't feel that way at all, but I might in the end. I wouldn't be surprised if I actually got to see it and sat down. I would be maybe appalled or delighted, like, depending where it lands. But I do feel like this is mine. Like, I did this and it's finished and it's between its covers and it's done. And then if somebody else who's creative thinks there's something in this that inspires them, like, that's awesome, you know? And they're going to make their thing and it will be different, and that's okay.
That's very mature of you.
Thank you very much.
Now, time to hear some questions from the audience.
Do you visualise when you're writing?
Yeah.
Are you in there as you go along?
I do. I feel it every step of the way. And as we grew up mostly in the cities, my dad worked in the Bank of Ireland, so we moved with his job. So we lived in Cork, Dublin, Limerick and Galway. And mostly we lived right in the edge of the cities, and there were always fields. And in those days, you played in the fields. You just go wild, you go swim in the river or whatever. We didn't have, you know, the running water and all that stuff would have been different, and we would have had all that. But the wildness of just being able to run wherever you wanted and do what you wanted. And then the difference, what strikes you when you leave Ireland that at the time seems completely normal, is that there's the ruins of a castle there, and there's an old house there, and there's another castle down there, and there's one that's been refurbished over there. And, you know, it's just old graveyards and things that you stumble across. And the history of the country is in every inch of it. And I feel that when I think about Ireland and when I write about it.
We talked earlier about, you know, you putting down the blinds yep. and putting on the rain sounds and, you know, going to Ireland to write it. But, I mean, what are your secrets or tips to really evoking a landscape in fiction?
I think it's just trying to get yourself in emotionally in a place where you're actually feeling something. Whatever you need to do to bring yourself there so you're not just in your head. And sometimes that's music, or it's just maybe reading something else by somebody else, watching a movie, or just thinking about it, going for a walk and thinking about it. Really trying to make yourself feel something, whatever it takes to make you feel something, even if it's not absolutely directly related to the point. Once you're in that mindset where you're feeling emotions, you can bring that feeling to what you're trying to write, I think.
I'm guessing you didn't get to go and do that research trip to Maine, you know, despite all the grand plans we were talking about earlier because of COVID, right?
Yeah.
So what do you do then when you can't actually do the research trip? And it's not a landscape you know as well as Galway.
It was very hard. I mean, it helps a bit that the memories I formed, I was very young when I formed them. And sometimes I think those memories are really super bright. You know, they're extra strong because it's often the first time you're experiencing something. I remember, I think this is actually in the book, but I remember after we finished work one night in the restaurant, we were in the bar, we were having a great time, and someone said, there's a party up on the mountain, you know, and it's in the most of the island is in a national park. And this guy was going to give us a lift. And it was only when I got in the car, I realized he was hammered. And I thought, oh no, this isn't good. But we survived the car journey and we ended up in this clearing in the forest. And there was just a bonfire and a keg and stars. And it was just mind-blowing, you know? It was just so beautiful. And I can still clearly see everything and feel everything and smell the fire and remember what it was like. You know, you're half scared because you're like, I just got in a car with a stranger and I'm in the middle of nowhere. But you're half super excited because there are loads of people there and it's really fun and you're in America, you know?
You're at a keg party in America!
It's crazy. And, you know, you're sitting on the logs around the bonfire later, and it was just amazing. And all those experiences are very clear in my mind. Like, a lot of them are just very strong memories, so that helped a lot. I think I would love to have gone back, but it just couldn't happen.
Yeah,
I'm just wondering over how you think the Irish will accept this book, seeing that you've
gone to America. Dish them.
I live in Ireland. I just wonder
how people think it'll be received. It's a really good question. I mean, it definitely was on my mind, but I think, if I'm really honest, Ireland is a country that is a very small country. It's part of Europe, and it's you know, it's very close to the US. So we've always been outward looking as a country, and we absorb, I think, more of other cultures than most do. In the Irish newspapers, you routinely get a lot of, you know, politics and social stuff from Europe, most European countries, and the US. And we look outside ourselves a lot, maybe too much sometimes. And the books I grew up with, a lot of them would have been not Irish. I think the fact now that Irish authors are so embraced in Ireland is brilliant, but it wasn't always that way. So I don't know that it is going to be an issue. Look, my hope always is, if the story is good, and the story is exciting, and you care about the characters, it really doesn't matter where it's set, as long as the setting is interesting and fun as well. I personally like to read a book that's going to bring me somewhere different. And whether that's Los Angeles or Edinburgh or Sydney or the bush, you know, I'm going there partly for the experience of where I get to travel to. So I hope for Irish people, they'll be interested in the setting and where this is, as well as the story, and the fact that it's no longer Cormac will not matter so much.
What about Australia? When are you going to write your novel set in Australia?
No. I'm so scared.
We're so parochial. Come on, Gemma.
You see, if I write it in Australia, you'll all hate it, and that would be the end of it. I'm afraid to write an Australian novel. I don't know why it is. It's just, I think I've lived here for 11 years. My kids are very Australian. So I feel like I'm part, like if I was to describe myself now, I don't know that I'd describe myself as purely Irish anymore. Somewhere over the years it shifted, and I think I would describe myself as Irish Australian. But I'm not Australian. I wasn't born and bred here. I don't understand things the way you guys understand them. I don't have all the nuance and the layers of meaning to things. And I'm terrified of messing it up. And I know you'd say, well, you wrote an American book and you're not American, but it just felt safer. I don't know what it is. I think because I'm here and I'll face the consequences directly.
I mean, that's Jane Harper, right? Like, yeah, Jane Harper came from the UK and is able to kind of write the Australian character and landscape with such skill.
Yes, but Jane is a genius. So,
as are you, Derv Lamentian. Yeah. Any more questions for Dervla? Yes.
Do you ever have a moment in the day or the week where you don't have the current story going around in your head?
Usually when one of the kids is screaming at me for something. When I'm really writing, when I'm really in a book and I'm writing, particularly first draft, I'm in the story most of the time. Like every time there's a break and I can think, if I'm driving, if I'm cooking, whatever I'm doing, I would be thinking about the story and kind of feeling it. And that's the best way to do it, which is why I try to write fast in the beginning, or regularly, every day if I can, because The quicker I'm, and Stephen King wrote this in On Writing, I think, he said that he tries to write at least 3,000 words a day because he said anything less than that and the story slows down too much and you lose kind of the feel of it. So I kind of try and think like that as well. I try and hit 3,000 a day when I'm starting with a new draft because that way it's alive. And if it's alive, it's like reading a book that you're really interested in. You're thinking about it and you want to get back to it.
This is a really silly. I'll come back to you. This is a silly question, but I just want to ask about your name, Dervla.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Because you know, on the front there it says D E R
V L A.
That's not how your name's actually spelled, is it?
No, it's not how it's spelled. No, it's D E A R B H L A in real life. But we had that conversation early on with my very nice editor, who was very diplomatic when she rang me. She was like, would you mind if we considered, because people won't know how to pronounce it and they won't know how to ask for it in bookshops, which is totally fair enough. But there's no B, there's no V in the Irish alphabet. There's only...
I have a sister, Niamh, N-I-A-M-H. Yeah.
So we use M-Hs and B-Hs to make the V sound.
Yeah.
But I don't think Dervla is too bad. You should hear my sister's names if you think they're tricky in terms of spelling.
You can tell us.
I have one sister called Ornith. Yeah. Which I will challenge you to spell.
Oh, gosh, and I'm half Irish and I'm not even giving that a go.
Ornith is spelled O-D-H-A-R-N-A-I-T.
Of course.
Obviously, clearly that's clear. My sister, my other sister is Eivín, which is A-O-I-B-H-I-N-N.
Beautiful.
And my other sister is Fiona, which is like Fiona but with a fada over the I.
Beautiful. I mean, they're gorgeous names. Is there, you know, like some sadness to not have your actual name on the cover?
Honestly, I suppose I feel like I'm, this is going to sound so cheesy, but I feel like I'm two different people and it's kind of nice.
Yeah.
You know, there's the writer person and then there's the real life person and they're two different people. So if I'm on school emails or whatever, I'm just myself. And then people don't know who you are.
They'll go, well, she's not that Dervla.
Yeah,
Mutina.
Exactly.
She's Dervla.
Yeah, he's your one. Yeah.
One last question from the crowd, if somebody has one. Yes. Oh, looks like we've got two. We can squeeze in two, I think.
Do you ever find yourself writing a character that you go, oops, that's me, or somebody else wrote
on? Yeah. Oh, that's so good. I had a character in The Ruin called Aisling, I think. Oh, my God, I'm forgetting. Aisling, the doctor in the hospital. And I loved her because she was so competent and so good at her job and so no-nonsense. And my sister Eivín, who's a GP and trained in the same hospital, and she hates Aisling. She thinks she's so into herself and she takes herself so seriously and everything else. And I actually think they're quite similar. So even though Eivín isn't into herself at all, she's just really dedicated and really cares about being a good doctor. And that's how I thought I was writing her, whereas Eivín thought she took herself way too seriously. So I thought that was funny. And I have a brother called Cormac, and he's convinced Cormac is written after him.
It's just a good name.
It's just a good name, yeah.
One last question here.
What are you working on next, I guess?
Yeah. Oh, I'm writing another story, another novel, which is also American. Sorry, guys. But it's about a young couple who go away together on a long break, and they're very much in love. They're part of a small community, so everybody knows everybody. And these are the sort of... They're not like the quarterback and the cheerleader. It's not like that, but they're just loved, you know? And they're very much in love. And they go away on a trip and he comes back and she doesn't. And everybody wants to know what happened. And it's a sort of a taking sides situation because obviously his parents are... His story doesn't quite make sense. Like, they're just things he said that people are thinking, what? That doesn't make sense. And so people start asking questions. His parents are incredibly protective of him, will do whatever it takes to keep him safe. But her parents want to know what happened, and they'll do whatever it takes to get to the bottom of her. And so it starts to kind of fragment things. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
How deep are you into that now?
Pretty deep. Pretty deep. When I come back, I'm going to be hitting the ground really hard on that one. I was writing something else that just didn't work for me, so I had to move away from it, and this is the one I'm on now, and it's working really well. So it's hard to interrupt it. Most of the year, you're a hermit, right? You're at home in your pyjamas most of the time, if you can get away with it, and you're writing, and you've got family life. And so then you get to do this for a very short time, and as a writer, you're always aware how bloody lucky you are that you get to do it, because not everybody does. So you have to just enjoy it.
And I mean, this is the dream, right? Like, yeah. This is when you said, I'm moving to Australia, I'm going to give up the law career, I'm going to pursue the dream, and here you are.
I don't even want to look at it too closely, because I feel like the more you look at it, the more likely it is to all fall apart.
Well, look, long may you reign. Devlin McTinnon, let's give her a huge round of applause.
That's the best-selling author Dervla McTiernan speaking with Claire Nichols about her latest, The Murder Rule. I'm Cassie McCullough, and if you want to hear more about books and writing, then make sure you join me and Kate Evans for The Bookshelf and Claire Nichols for The Book Show each week on Radio National or via the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.